I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. President Obama has been answering questions during his trip to Europe this week about the surprise prisoner swap involving U.S. Army Sergeant Bo Bergdahl for five members of the Taliban held at Guantanamo Bay. The exchange has been criticized by members of Bergdahl's unit who claim he was a deserter who endangered his fellow soldiers, and by members of Congress who say the administration kept them in the dark. Pundits have been having a field day. Here's what Obama said yesterday in Brussels.
This is not some abstraction. This is not a political football. You have a couple of parents whose kid volunteered to fight in a distant land, who they hadn't seen in 5 years and weren't sure whether they'd ever see again. And as Commander-in-Chief of the United States Armed Forces, I am responsible for those kids. And I get letters from parents who say, if you are in fact sending my child into war, make sure that that child is being taken care of. And I write too many letters to folks who unfortunately don't see their children again after fighting a war. I make absolutely no apologies for making sure that we get back a young man to his parents, and that the American people understand that this is somebody's child, and that we don't condition whether or not we make the effort to try to get them back.
Joining us to talk about the legal questions involved in this prisoner exchange are Eugene Fidel and Rachel Van Landingham. Eugene Fidel teaches military justice at Yale Law School. He's also founder and former president of the National Institute of Military Justice. It's been a couple of years. Nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Nice to be back with you.
And also with us, as I said, Rachel Van Landingham. She's a visiting assistant professor at Stetson University College of Law. That's in Florida. Formerly chief of international law at U.S. Central Command under Generals Dempsey and Petraeus. Currently serves on the advisory board of the National Institute of Military Justice. And was a judge advocate in the Air Force for about 20 years. And Rachel Van Landingham, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Gene, if I could begin with you, and even picking up on what President Obama just said, is the leave no soldier behind credo an absolute?
Long pause.
Yeah, long pause. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean,
what are you thinking?
I would say yes. If you're saying the answer is yes, unless you're talking about somebody who has literally joined the other side. In other words, somebody you might have somebody, for example, who had roots in another country who might be a dual citizen or something like that. I mean, it would have to be pretty flaky. But somebody who says, well, I'm actually going to fight with the, then fill in the blank of, you know, some other country. And, you know, would we exert ourselves strenuously to retrieve such a person? Well, only if we really wanted to take him and put him in front of a court-martial, actually. But barring that, we basically are going to try to get any GI back if it's at all possible. The debate is, what's possible?
Right. Right, and I want to pick up on that, but let me give you, Rachel, a chance to weigh in on that as well. Do we condition getting back soldiers, Marines that are being held?
No, I don't think so. I agree with Gene. The credo is rather absolute, and that's manifest or demonstrated by the efforts that the United States has undergone for years to retrieve the remains of U.S. soldiers and Air Force and Naval personnel in Korea and in Vietnam. And I think there is a distinction between the efforts and the principle of retrieving a lost soldier and the consequences of a soldier's potential misconduct when they do return, and I think those can be separated.
The idea that once, and we clearly are talking about Bergdahl here, once he gets home, then he will face or have to explain to the military what he was doing and why he left the base?
Well, I'm sure, even if there was absolutely no indication of misconduct, there, of course, would be debriefings and discussions regarding his time in captivity so we can learn more about the enemy and the circumstances that led up to that captivity, irrespective of any type of criminal justice aura over those discussions.
And, Gene, even going back to you, and, of course, it seems like every hour we're learning more, there's more information about Bo Bergdahl, and so there are even reports today that he apparently had left this outpost before, had come back. It was also true during his training. How are you looking at his, I guess, coming and going?
Yeah, that's been an interesting addition to the recipe, hasn't it? That's the great thing about law. It's so unpredictable. You know, as the facts sort of dribble out, you think you've got it in focus, and then something comes at you from left field, and you say, wait, not so fast. Look, the government, assuming that he is subject to disciplinary action, and by the way, can I digress for one second?
Of course.
Do we have a minute? Rachel mentioned that Sergeant Bergdahl is being debriefed. There's an issue there, by the way, that we should recognize, which is he's, I think, suspected of an offense, namely desertion, or at least AWOL. So somebody is going to have to sort out, or maybe already has, whether he's got to be given warnings. You know, the right to silence. It does apply to the military. And,
Gene, as you know, that even if they decide, the government decides not to give him those warnings, then they are foregoing the use of his statements in any type of prosecution.
Right, and anything that flows from his statements. But, you know, the duty is there to give the warnings. So sometimes the military, for one reason or another, doesn't give warnings. But that, not to get too far down that rabbit hole, but at least to flag that there's an issue there. So what about his coming and going?
Yes.
The question that's going to have to be demonstrated in the event of a court-martial, and by the way, let's not jump to conclusions, and also, certainly, let's not convict Sergeant Bergdahl on radio, right?
I agree, totally, yes.
You know, to flag that for this conversation.
Absolutely.
The government will have to prove, in order to obtain a conviction for desertion, that he had the intent to remain away permanently. That's typically done by circumstantial evidence. It's rare that somebody writes on the blackboard, "Goodbye, Sarge, you're never going to see me again. I'm deserting." So,
that doesn't happen.
What's that?
That doesn't happen.
Not very often.
Right.
Well, the last several desertions, though, Gene, that have actually secured convictions in current modern courts martial, I have involved primarily plea agreements where the individual admits to the intent to remain away permanently. And so those are obviously, well, you have an admission, or in the case of Sergeant Riviera a few years ago in Castillo, they admitted why they were on the lam, so to speak, that they were, they fled to Canada and said, "We're here because we never want to return to the United States and serve in Iraq." So we do have cases of clear-cut admissions, and as Gene is pointing out, it's difficult to prove that intent to remain away permanently. But if these are true allegations that Sergeant Bergdahl did have a tendency or a proclivity to wander away from base from time to time, the fact that he returned on earlier alleged unauthorized absences, that weighs against the fact that he wasn't going to return on this unauthorized absence. But I would like to foot stomp, as Gene did, that we don't know the facts here, and these are all hypotheticals and suppositions, and there's a presumption of innocence that really has to be strongly underscored here.
Absolutely. And let me even read an email that he sent out, and this is while he was stationed at this outpost complaining about the U.S. Army's treatment of Afghan civilians. He says these people need help, yet what they get is the most conceited country in the world telling them they are nothing, that they are stupid, that they have no idea how to live. We don't even care when we hear each other talk about running their children down in the dirt streets with our armored trucks. We make fun of them in front of their faces and laugh at them for not understanding. We are insulting them. I am sorry for everything, the horror that is America is discussing. And he goes on from there. But, I mean, clearly this was someone who at least on paper and in this email, cared about the Afghan people and cared about how the U.S. was treating them and was obviously very critical about that. Gene, if I can go back to you, you know, should he have complained to his supervisors? Perhaps he even did. We don't even know that. But here's someone who is struggling, you know, in this far out outpost, dealing with things that obviously clearly disturb him.
Right. There's no question about that. Complaining to his supervisors, you know, look, people that go into the military, everybody's a volunteer these days, by the way, right. Just remember that. People that go into the military are a reflection of American society, and thank goodness, we are a very diverse society. Maybe we're split right down the middle politically, but, you know, really people continue to be able to have their own opinions, and that goes for people in the military as well. Mm-hmm. The problem is when people act on their beliefs that are incompatible, in a way that is incompatible with military service. And we have certain, there is a safety valve. The safety valve is that a person who's already on active duty can ask to be treated as a conscientious objector. The problem is that we, like I think every country, or maybe there's one or two exceptions, but we don't permit selective conscientious objection. So a person who really, really doesn't believe in what we have been trying to do in Afghanistan or Iraq or fill in the blank doesn't have the option to say, well, count me out for this one.
Mm.
So that safety valve, which we do recognize, and it doesn't have to be religiously based, incidentally, that safety valve doesn't function where you have somebody who has basically a political disagreement or a disagreement with the political objectives that the military is trying on behalf of our country to achieve.
Richard, let me go back to you and even pick up on something that both you and Gene said, which is that he is innocent until proven guilty. I absolutely want to underscore that. But what do you make of the fact that there is, even from his own unit, people calling him a traitor, a deserter, the kind of vitriol that has been leveled against him? How do you understand that? Because it seems quite unusual.
Well, I'm not a psychologist, just a law professor, but you know, there are individuals that are going to make up their own minds when they're not privy to all the facts. And I did witness one of his former colleagues in his infantry unit speak disparagingly of him on Morning Joe the other day, and he was describing him as being different and being quiet, not part of the team. And I got kind of a sense that, you know, they didn't like him because he was different than the rest of them. And I mean, I applaud the fact that we have individuals that are different within the military that are willing to speak up and ask questions and be critical thinkers. So I'm not sure if part of this was the fact that he wasn't as much of a team player as some of his other unit, as some of his other unit mates.
And we're almost up in a break here, but do you think it just also represents a kind of frustration that so many who have served in Afghanistan are feeling these days?
Well, absolutely. And if there's a sense that he shirked duty or walked away when others stood the line and exposed themselves to risk or paid the ultimate sacrifice, that's an anger that's legitimate.
Well, let's take that short break and we'll get back to our guest. That's Rachel Van Landingham, and she's a visiting assistant professor at Stetson University College of Law in Florida. She was the chief of international law at U.S. Central Command. Eugene Fidel, also with us, teaches military justice at Yale Law School and co-founded and was a former president of the National Institute of Military Justice. And we are talking about the legal questions involved with Bo Bergdahl, and that, of course, leads to a whole host of other questions as well. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, the 2014 Lincoln MKX, which comes with available adaptive HID headlamps and standard heated and cooled front seats. More details about the Lincoln MKX are available at Lincoln.com.
Abington Health supports WHYY. Chronic joint and spine pain can affect men and women over the age of 50, interrupting their sleep and severely limiting their daily activities. Abington Health's joint and spine specialists have many treatment options, including minimally invasive joint replacement and spine surgery, performed at the Abington Health Orthopedic and Spine Institute. Information is available at 215-481-MEDI.
Whether you're just waking up or you're on your commute, the news is always happening. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Jennifer Lynn. WHYY and NPR's reporters are covering the stories around the block and across the globe that will fuel your day and keep you informed.
So if your alarm is set to 90.9 or were the first preset on your car's radio,
it's radio so vibrant you can almost see it.
And our reporters never take shortcuts.
Morning Edition, weekday mornings on WHYY. Supporting WHYY, Roadside Attractions, presenting Words and Pictures, an adult romantic dramedy about two teachers whose heated sparring ignites a passion for life and possibly love, starring Clive Owen and Juliette Binoche, now playing in select theaters.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Eugene Fidel and Rachel Van Landingham about some of the legal and military questions involved with Bo Bergdahl, the exchange of Bo Bergdahl for five members of the Taliban who were held for many, many years at Guantanamo Bay. And again, calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Gene, if I could go back to you, did President Obama, as Commander-in-Chief, as you understand it, did he have the authority to in a sense, order this exchange?
Yes, I believe he did. It may be worth taking a minute to sort of unpack this, because there's been a lot of energy and hot air expended on the subject. Congress has, we're dealing with two kinds of prisoners here. We're dealing with the detainees that we hold at Guantanamo, mm-hmm. column one. Column two is Sergeant Bergdahl. In column one, Congress has, in several steps, made it very, very difficult for the president to either bring detainees from Guantanamo onto the mainland, or to export them back to their own country or other countries. The wisdom or not of that is not the point. But Congress has required certifications, a fairly onerous process. There it is. It has been said by people on Capitol Hill, and I guess elsewhere, that the president violated an act of Congress and by not notifying the leaders of the House and Senate or certain committees that this deal was going to go down. And this has been an opportunity to treat the president more or less like a piñata. Hmm. I think that is deeply unfair, and it also misunderstands the structure of the federal government. We have a three-part government. Everybody knows there's three branches: the executive, legislative, and judicial. The president has certain powers under the Constitution that are expressly his. One is to be commander-in-chief of the Army and Navy, is what it says, but of the armed forces. And the concept is, and Congress also, of course, has powers, including the power to deal with captures on land and sea. The problem is, or the concept that we use the phrase separation of powers to describe, is that the three branches are supposed to basically stay in their own lane. Congress, I believe, either directly or on an as-applied basis, got in the president's lane, or would be getting in the president's lane if it prevented him as commander-in-chief from making the kind of individualized tactical judgments that have to be made when dealing with a situation where one of our military personnel has fallen into or wandered into the wrong hands. And I think people who have faulted the president for violating the statute that requires consultation when offloading people from Guantanamo are missing the point.
Well, and let me pick up on that and turn to you, Rachel. And Gene was talking about the National Defense Authorization Act. The act said that the president had to tell members of Congress if he was getting people out of Guantanamo Bay. He did issue a signing statement on that, which, of course, complicates the issue. I'd be curious about whether how you see this.
I agree with Gene that I thought that this was a lawful transfer in exercise of the president's commander-in-chief authorities under Article 2, Section 2 of the Constitution. And I would like to point out that Section 1035 of 2014's National Defense Authorization Act, that's what the hubbub allegedly is about on Capitol Hill. It is not a consultation requirement. It is purely a notification requirement. Congress did not require the president to seek their approval or to seek their advice or to seek their consult. They merely require that he notify them. So, you know, I do think that's critical in laying out the proper context of what he did not follow, and he clearly did not follow that notification procedure. However, I believe that his commander-in-chief authority when the life of a U.S. soldier was at risk, as we heard some members of the administration and the president himself, I believe, yesterday state that they had serious and reasonable fears that Sergeant Bergdahl would be killed if news of this release would be would leak. And so I think that is the difficult choice that a president has to make, and that Article 2 gives him that authority. And the Supreme Court, to be honest, has backed up this type of authority going all the way back to a famous case called the Curtis Wright case, in which they specifically said that the president, not Congress, has the better opportunity of knowing the conditions which prevail in foreign countries, and especially this is true in time of war. And I bring up that case because this also deals with the foreign relations with another country, and that's that third country of Qatar, which agreed to hold the Taliban detainees for a year. And so there were sensitive negotiations going on not only with the individuals holding Sergeant Bergdahl, but also with a foreign nation that agreed to take the Taliban detainees. And that leads me to a related point, and that is the clock was ticking on these Taliban detainees anyway. They were not long for Guantanamo Bay detention because our authority as a country to hold them rests on classic law of war prisoner authority. You can hold a combatant, a belligerent, until the cessation of hostilities. President Obama announced a week and a half ago at West Point that combat missions in Afghanistan will end at the end of 2014 and that U.S. troops would be out at the end of 2015. So a year transition way station at Qatar brings these five detainees pretty much to the end of the cessation of hostilities. So I think that's definitely a factor that needs to be brought up. And there is the rest of the National Defense Authorization Act, in which Congress required that the Secretary of Defense certify that these detainees either were no longer a security risk to the United States, or that there were sufficient mitigating procedures put in place to mitigate any such threat. And I haven't seen any specifics on this yet, but I would dare to say that the administration followed the rest of the National Defense Authorization Act. We haven't heard anyone say that the president didn't follow the rest of that component. It was only the notification.
And picking up on that, Jean, the five detainees released from Guantanamo going to Qatar, they are described as, you know, high-level members of the Taliban. Of course, this goes back more than 10 years when they were captured. I mean, I'm assuming there are always risks in some kind of prisoner exchange, and this is not a traditional war like the end of World War II, where there were peace signings and prisoner exchanges and everyone sort of went back to business as usual. This is different because of this sort of so-called war on terror, it seems to me.
Well, it's different, but it's not different. Look, in past wars of the more conventional kind, there was something called a cartel. Not like, you know, the sugar cartel, but
right.
A cartel is simply an exchange of prisoners. And we did in the Civil War. And there were difficulties associated with it, and at times a lack of trust. And the deal was that a prisoner who was paroled or carteled, you know, back home, was supposed not to go back into the fight. I'm going to let you in on a little secret.
Go ahead.
It happened. So anybody that thinks, look, these people are never going to lift a finger against the United States, or they're going to be entirely apolitical and spend the remainder of their lives reading literature, That's unrealistic. They're not youngsters. They're in their 40s, I guess. But, you know, they're going to be politically active. And by the way, we may wind up dealing with the Taliban government two years from now, for all we know.
Well, that's interesting you say that, because I was thinking, and perhaps I'll toss this to you, Rachel, and then we'll get to some of our callers, which is whether this was a kind of a trial run for what it might be like to negotiate with the Taliban. Do you see it that way?
Well, I think it was a component of an overall architecture of negotiations. I mean, there have been negotiations to attempt to provide some type of peace, and I use that term loosely, in Afghanistan for years, and this is one component, you know, a large driving factor. But I think peace negotiations of some type were necessary in order to successfully pull our troops back from Afghanistan. Again, this, either the war in Afghanistan per se against al-Qaeda, which I or against the Taliban, which is distinct from the more transnational or global war against al-Qaeda, we can't kill our way out of these things. You have to discuss and and negotiate, so to speak, with the enemy when you're going to call something and deal with it as they call it a war.
We have a tweet from, looks like, Feldy. Is there any historical precedent for court-martialing an American soldier who was held as a POW? Gene, is there any precedent for that?
Yes, there is, but they're very sparse. And the circumstances under which, I'll give you the most recent one that I'm familiar with. That's Sergeant Jenkins, who during the Vietnam War happened to have been stationed in South Korea and walked across the border and basically defected to North Korea, where he later surfaced as an old man, and when he came back into our hands, we gave him a little court-martial, and I think he served 30 days in a brig in Japan, and then, you know, that was that. I think his mother was dying or something. But earlier than that, there have been instances where U.S. service personnel have been taken prisoner by various adversaries and then have misbehaved in custody. So they become turncoats. They help the captors beat up or otherwise mistreat fellow Americans. That we take a very dim view of. And if we catch those people, they're in serious trouble.
And that's
and it's happened occasionally.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Eugene Fidel. He is actually teaches military justice at the Yale Law School and a former president and founder of the National Institute of Military Justice. Rachel Van Lanningham currently serves on the advisory board of the National Institute of Military Justice. She's a visiting assistant professor at Stetson University College of Law. That's in Florida. And formerly chief of international law at U.S. Central Command.
Let me mention, by the way, Rachel is being very modest this morning. She's actually vice president of NIMJ. So
okay.
Congratulations on the air. Shout out for Rachel.
There you go.
Well, thank you, Gene. I'm trying to follow in your footsteps.
Oh, just too much love today on Radio Times. Let me get some callers in at 1-888-477-9499. And again, you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times, or you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. We're talking about some of the complicated but very, very, very important legal questions involving this prisoner exchange with Bo Bergdahl and five members of the Taliban who were held at Guantanamo. Let me get Karen from Westchester to join us on Radio Times. And Karen, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, just a couple of comments. As a lawyer myself, I really appreciate your speakers talking about if Bo Bergdahl does have any charges brought against him, then he may have some very strong defenses that I'm seeing. So to convict him in the court of public opinion is so unfair. Number two, I hope that everybody in the Delaware Valley listening to this who feels as I do will send cards and tweets and emails and whatever they can to the besieged people in Haley, Idaho, to give them support and to give support to Bo Bergdahl's family, the terrible public campaign going on against them. And just a real final comment, I don't think this is about Bo Bergdahl at all. It's part of the Get Barack Obama on Any Grounds movement in this country. So sad, but I really hope that people will send their support to the people of Haley, Idaho, and to the Bergdahl family.
Karen, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And Rachel, they apparently have canceled whatever homecoming celebration they had planned. They were, sounds like, afraid in this town in Idaho that there would be problems.
Yes, and I think that really is unfortunate. From the news accounts, they were afraid of protests and perhaps, you know, violence. And it's tapping to something that you mentioned earlier, Marty, and that is this wellspring of vitriol and of anger. And I think really at the end of the day, that's emblematic of anger at seeing our sons and daughters lost in Afghanistan, especially how many years past 9/11. And even if those deaths are justified, and I would definitely argue that they were, death is hard to grapple with, and we would like to provide, if we can't hit the Taliban or Al-Qaeda ourselves, we would like to beat up on somebody, and so I think this has provided perhaps a punching bag of sorts to bring out that anger.
But, you know, what I find so frustrating is that, you know, there is a real conversation to be had about this prisoner exchange. Hopefully we're having it today on the show. But what's so disturbing is just all the finger-pointing and the frankly, a lot of the misinformation that's going out there and people being called traitors and all of that. It's just, it's so frustrating to try to have a normal conversation.
what's a normal conversation?
Oh, I don't know. Maybe we've lost sight of that. I don't know, but it's very frustrating.
You know, I have to say I was disturbed to find out that some of the other GIs who were in this unit were being given advice by some public relations shop, some lobby shop or public relations shop on K Street. I think that's really unfortunate, and I really hope that we're not back into the Swift boat times.
Let me get, it looks like actually Bernie now to join us. Bernie calling us from Pennsauken. Go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Oh, good morning.
Hi.
I heard one of your attorneys say that Bo Bergdahl was a prisoner of war. It is my understanding that he was never listed by the military as a prisoner of war. So would they clarify that, please?
Greg, let me toss that to Rachel.
For someone technically to be a prisoner of war only applies in what's termed an international armed conflict per the Geneva Conventions. And an international armed conflict is between two nation states. For example, the beginning of the conflict between the United States and Afghanistan was an international armed conflict. But by 2009, the legal classification, at least the de facto legal classification of the conflict, had changed within Afghanistan to be what is called a non-international armed conflict, or a conflict between and among a nation state and a non-state armed group, the insurgency, which the Taliban then became. We were helping President Karzai's government, and can continue to do so, fight an insurgency. Mm. In a non-international armed conflict, there is no classification or status of a prisoner of war. By analogy, he definitely was a prisoner of war, but really he was a detainee, just like the detainees in Guantanamo Bay and in the detention facility in Parwan that the U.S. Continues to hold a few detainees. They are detained because of their belligerent action, because of their status as a belligerent within an armed conflict. And once that armed conflict ends, regardless of how dangerous we think that they are, we no longer have the legal authority under international law to hold those individuals. There's a time frame that there's some squishiness on the end of the cessation of hostilities. But going back to Sergeant Bergdahl, technically he was not a prisoner of war because the type of fight that we were in does not allow that type of classification.
About 30 seconds before our second break, Gene, anything you want to add to what Rachel just said?
Well, Rachel's absolutely right as a matter of the black letter law of armed conflict. POW has achieved a certain currency in American parlance, I think for most people who are not international lawyers, this walks like a duck.
Well, let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation. That's Eugene Fidel, again, teaches military justice at Yale Law School. Rachel Van Landingham, visiting assistant professor at Stetson University College of Law in Florida. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. Again, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Questions or comments? Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Bad energy habits around the office can affect your bottom line. PICO Smart Ideas for your business can help with customized tips, information, and programs designed to save you energy and money. Learn more at pico.com/smartideas. PICO supports WHYY.
The 83rd Annual June Rittenhouse Square Fine Art Show supports WHYY and circles the square in Philadelphia's Rittenhouse Square at 18th and Walnut, Friday through Sunday, June 6th to 8th. Open Friday and Saturday, 11 a.m. to 7 p.m., and Sunday from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. Featuring original artwork from over 140 locally and nationally recognized artists, prints, drawings, and sculptures will be exhibited. The Rittenhouse Square Fine Art Show. Details available at rittenhousesquareart.com.
A lifetime ago, living and dying on the beaches at Normandy.
Every man that came through that machine gun fire and landed on Omaha Beach, every man was a hero.
June 6, 1944, forever known as D-Day. And as the men who lived it slowly passed from the scene, the efforts to preserve the oral history left behind. Next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Sharrett Winery supports WHYY and will hold their 6th annual Wine and Music Festival on June 7th and 8th. This family-friendly festival features 8 local wineries with more than 80 wines for tasting, as well as food, music, and local crafters. More at sharrettwinery.com.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. The release of Bo Bergdahl for 5 members of the Taliban held at Guantanamo Bay raises a number of complex and important legal, military, and political questions, and that's what we're talking about today on Radio Times with Rachel Van Landingham and Eugene Fidel. Let me get Greg to join us. Greg calling us from Valley Forge.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Enjoy your show.
Thank you.
I'm somewhat incredulous over the reaction to Bergdahl as being a deserter, a turncoat, and all that. I was in Vietnam for 13 and a half months, and most of the time I served as a battalion legal clerk. And we had any number of young, immature, misguided guys took off for a few days, or, you know, or altruistic people who thought they should work with the people in the countryside. And some of them deserted, if you will, or left, joined colonies of others. A deserter came back a month, 6 weeks later or something like that because they were hungry. We didn't think these people were deserters or criminals of any sort. And the way the Army looked at it at that time, first time it happened was an insubordination charge for it within Article 15. Second one in Article 15 was been busted down to E1. Third time, maybe you get a special court with severe restrictions, but no jail time. And if it keeps happening again, we process paperwork to discharge them for unsuitability or unfitness. Everybody knew there was bums and deadheads in the military. You know, you go out on guard with one of these guys on a brink, on a perimeter, and you knew you were going to have to stay up all night because they were a bum or high on drugs. But this is a constant part of military life. I've talked to my father about this, and he said every branch of the service has these kinds of people. They're not deserters. They're just immature.
Well, you know, Greg, I appreciate the call. Let me give our guests a chance to respond. Gene, if I could just start with you, a bit of a history lesson there.
Well, I first of all, I would never argue with somebody from Valley Forge.
That's probably very good advice. Yes,
you got me already. You know, I wasn't in Vietnam, but I was on active duty during that period, and I appreciate your intervention on this. That's the kind of valuable intelligence that people need as they form their values about what has unfolded here. Let me also say this: we really need to know more.
Yes.
About, you know, what happened with Sergeant Bergdahl before, during, after. The one thing I would say is I think that General Dempsey or somebody said, look, we can only find out from Sergeant Bergdahl himself. And that I don't agree with. Yes, there are things that he knows that no one else knows, but we may not have the opportunity to get Sergeant Bergdahl's full story here.
And why is that? Why is that?
Well, because he's exposed to a substantial jail term, and he may not want to cooperate.
But Rachel, you know, I don't think I want to make light of the fact that people, or certainly Bergdahl or others, you know, leave their unit, because it sounds like under these circumstances, people went looking for him, and that, of course, raises a whole host of safety concerns.
Well, I agree with you, Marty. I mean, it is a very serious charge or allegation that someone knowingly and intentionally left their unit without authorization. But your last caller does make a great point, and that is there are gradations of leaving and gradations of misconduct, and not all misconduct leads to less than honorable service within the military. There are numerous individuals in both Iraq and Afghanistan that have left their operating posts, left their main FOBs, forward operating bases, in order to get drugs, to seek sex, to go on a little sightseeing tour. By and large, those individuals were dealt with, as your caller mentioned, similar to Vietnam, with what's called non-judicial punishment, or punishment that falls in administrative proceedings that fall underneath a court-martial. And then they go on to serve their time. And I think that brings up an interesting point. If some of these rumors and allegations that Sergeant Bergdahl had left his post in the past, what was his leadership doing about that? Were these flags that perhaps there were other issues going on with Sergeant Bergdahl that needed to be addressed? Did they do anything about it? Or was it condoned, and therefore perhaps he thought it was okay? And that really goes back to Gene's point and our theme all along, that we simply do not know, and we do not know what exactly happened, and we may never know. And the presumption of innocence means that if we do not know, then he is innocent of misconduct.
Let me
go ahead, Gene.
Once more, because this is really we're probably now at the heart of the matter in terms of what ought to be done. It has been stressed by not just by other people in the unit, but more broadly that other GIs were put at risk in efforts to find Sergeant Bergdahl when on this. His walk in the country. Let me share with you a case.
Go ahead.
And I know this will ring a bell with Rachel, and if there are any other listeners who have been lawyers in the service, it'll ring a bell. I'm referring to the great case of United States against Sidinsky. Sidinsky was a young man assigned to the aircraft carrier Intrepid, the one that's up in New York right now.
Oh, yeah.
Right. So Sidinsky, on a bet, jumped off the aircraft carrier underway. Got this?
Yep.
And lo and behold, as Admiral Kirby, the Navy's public relations representative, said the other day, when this kind of thing happens, when there's a man overboard, person overboard, that person is retrieved. And that's exactly what happened here. Another ship in the formation went and got Sidinsky, fished him out of the drink. Okay, end of story. Not quite. Sidinsky was prosecuted. He got 5 months in the brig,
Wow. And
I think he got a bad conduct discharge. And one of the points that the then U.S. Court of Military Appeals made, quoting a government's brief, was that it was important to take into account the possibility of endangering the property and lives of others in rescue operations. So the whole business of rescue is not a red herring. It's a significant government interest that's being vindicated there. And it's something that has to be taken into account because mindful as we are that young people do foolish things, even in quite dangerous parts of the world, it's also intolerable in a military unit for people to be, armies of one.
Hmm. Let me go back to you, Rachel, and then I do want to get back to our callers, which it looks like the phones have actually just exploded here a bit because there's so much to talk about. This is something that was in the New York Times today. They referenced a classified military report about Sergeant Bergdahl, and this is, I believe it's an op-ed, an editorial in the Times today, and they write, if anything, the report suggests that the Army unit's lack of security and discipline was as much to blame for the disappearance, given the sergeant's history. Sort of picking up on this idea that if he had left before, what were his what was the unit doing to keep an eye on him, and whether if there were discipline problems at the unit, if that's a mitigating circumstance.
Well, actually, I mean, that's very real. Those are very real factors and considerations that the commander who has to decide the disposition of the situation has to take into account, because there are many levels of disposition, and it leads to, because Sergeant Sidinsky was court-martialed, and rightly so, for putting his unit at risk, does that mean that someone else who put his unit at risk, if that's what Sergeant Bergdahl did, should be court-martialed? Well, we also have to look at, well, Sergeant Sidinsky, he was in the Navy, so not Sergeant, but Sidinsky did not
airman
serve
recruit,
five.
Airman recruit, I think.
Oh, was the airman recruit? Yes, Sidinsky did not serve 5 years as a, well, euphemistically called it a prisoner of war. So, has there been punishment enough, or is the symbolic message that a court martial, if there were individuals put at risk because of misconduct, is it worth it? And then that brings me to another corollary point, which is that, assume that individuals are put at risk. Assume that there's a decision to court-martial because there was misconduct that led to fellow service members being put at risk and the significant diversion of resources, et cetera. if Sergeant Bergdahl received a bad conduct discharge or any kind of punitive discharge, what would happen to his VA benefits? So for someone that suffered for 5 years as a prisoner of war and conceivably has undergone some type of, you know, significant, you know, mental, you know, distress because of that, are we then going to cut off all of his VA benefits? And so I think we have to, the commander that has to make this incredibly difficult decision does have to weigh out those factors when considering the disposition. And they do have to consider the fact that this individual, even if it was because of his own misconduct, did serve involuntarily as a prisoner on behalf of the United States. And so all those factors really do need to come into the consideration of a fair, appropriate, and warranted just disposition.
Let me get just quickly, Gene, if you don't mind.
Yeah, very quickly. Your question had to do with whether what account should be taken of the fact that the unit may have been a mess. And
yes,
the answer there is I don't think that's a defense at all. I don't think it's an extenuating circumstance. If the unit was a mess, that has to be dealt with by disciplining or otherwise shaking up the people who are responsible for that. And as far as, certainly sentries are there for a purpose, but the purpose is not to keep people from going over the fence out. They're to keep people from coming over the fence in. So the fact that the unit was not totally squared away, I don't think helps Sergeant Bergdahl at all.
Let me get, looks like Cadet Mauser from Delaware Valley to join us on Radio Times. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I just had a quick comment about the fact that Bergdahl stayed alive for, all these years, which is, I don't know, five. Usually with Al-Qaeda and, their style of, fighting, from an experience that I've observed when I was in Iraq back in 2007 when an OP was ambushed and one of the soldiers was kidnapped, they were immediately killed. Mm-hmm. And same thing with Operation Red Wings, when the Navy SEAL was also, taken by some of the Afghanis. The Taliban were trying their best to not even kill him, but also, behead him. And he was just able to basically stay alive for 5 years. And that raises a lot of questions. And also, the anger from a lot of the service members, including guys from his unit, comes from the fact that they all believe that he just walked out. Because if it was, if he was abducted, if he was taken, then, and if he didn't have that much security, then he could have easily taken somebody else.
Let me ask you a question. Are you saying that, the fact that he was able to stay alive, what does that tell you? What do you think that means?
Sympathizing with, with the top 10, because, and that, what backs up my theory is the fact that before he actually disappeared, from what I've heard on the news, that he sent a letter to his family stating, that he doesn't believe in the war and, sympathizing with the people that he's fighting against.
Okay, well, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And again, so many pieces of this story. Rachel, do you have any thoughts?
Well, that's that the methods of the enemy evolve over time, and this has been a long fight. And there was intelligence that's been on in some of the news reports that the Taliban planned on reusing Bergdahl in order to gain release of some of their colleagues from Guantanamo Bay. So they had great incentive not to kill Sergeant Bergdahl. We have no indication that Sergeant Bergdahl was actually collaborating with the enemy or was anything but an involuntary prisoner of the enemy. And just because he wrote a letter home saying he was dissatisfied, well, if all the GIs that write letters home saying they're dissatisfied with the war are considered sympathizers, then I think we're in trouble.
I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Gene, let me just pick up on something because I think there's also been some confusion about the Taliban versus Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda has been designated a terrorist group by this country. The Taliban has not, and I think some people use those words interchangeably.
I think that's true, and there was a nuance, in fact, when this entire campaign began, as to back to the POW issue, are both Taliban and Al-Qaeda in the same basket? And the answer is they're not. The Taliban, remember, at a time were the government of Afghanistan, and the Taliban were the army of Afghanistan. Al-Qaeda never had any pretense in that direction. So I think we've got to keep our categories straight.
We don't have time for the question, but Rachel, I'm going to read it to you. This is from Rob from Community College. Would John McCain not be considered a POW because it wasn't an international conflict based off the definition, I guess, that you just gave?
Well, I think that was an international armed conflict with Vietnam. I'm going to need Gene's help there a little bit on why he was so classified as a prisoner of war.
Yeah, do you know, Gene?
He was the genuine article, and that was an international armed conflict. I mean, we were in combat with North Korea, which is a recognized nation state. I mean, that's an easy one. That's pure classic.
With North Vietnam.
It was
a classic international armed conflict between two nation states. Even though we were helping the South Vietnamese government, we were at war with, even though an undeclared war, as they all have been since World War II, an undeclared war against another nation state. Therefore, it was an international armed conflict that full Geneva Conventions applied.
Well, we could go on, as I said, a lot of things to talk about. I appreciate the fact that you both gave us an hour. Rachel Van Landingham, thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having us.
You're welcome. And she's visiting assistant professor at Stetson University College of Law in Florida. She serves on the advisory board of the National Institute of Military Justice, mm-hmm. apparently is the vice president. And that's because Eugene Fidel told us, and he teaches military justice at Yale Law School and former president and co-founder of the National Institute of Military Justice. Gene Fidel, thank you very much as well.
Thank you, and thanks to your listeners for great questions.
Indeed. And good.
And in memory of all those troops, since today is the commemoration of Normandy.
Absolutely. Another thing to remember as well. And go to WHYY.org/Radio Times. You can carry on this conversation on our Facebook page or on our homepage. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thank you so much for joining us in this First Hour Radio Times. Tuesday with us. We'll be right back.